ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 27th of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. It was meant to be an evening of fun and frivolity for the US president in the assembled White House press corps. But the music and hubbub of conversation at the correspondents' dinner was soon interrupted. US President Donald Trump was surrounded and evacuated after the security serious incident during the White House correspondents' dinner. A man had breached a security checkpoint just outside the gala event, with officials saying he was armed with two guns and multiple knives. It has once again raised questions about the security protocols around President Donald Trump and his senior staff. Our America's editor, John Lyons, was there. He joined me a short time ago.
Melissa, it was extraordinary. This is the big night in Washington, D.C. This is power, this is access, all in one room, 2,500 or so people, probably half of the Trump administration's cabinet, top media owners, editors, executive producers. Like, I walked through one corridor and Scott Bessent was next to me in the bathroom. You know, it was Stephen Miller, the immigration czar, RFK Jr. walked by. It was anybody and everybody who makes the difference and makes the decisions in Washington. Everyone sat down, national anthem, and about 10 minutes later, all hell broke loose. And it was difficult. Part of the panic of people in the room, people were diving under their tables. A lot of people heard the four or five shots outside, the gunshots just outside the ballroom, but people didn't know whether there was the shooter was in the room or there was a second one. So then the Secret Service were running through the room trying to extract all of these VIPs, all of these members of cabinet, and trying to sort of run them through the crowd. So it was absolute chaos. And what I found extraordinary was how in a matter of a minute or two, a room can go from 2,500 of the most powerful people in America to suddenly one of chaos and danger.
What was your impression about the security that was in place, given there were not just the president, but as you say, so many senior officials in the room?
I thought the security was appalling. I arrived at the premises of the Washington Hilton. Bear in mind, this is where decades ago Ronald Reagan had an assassination attempt on him at the very same hotel in the car park. But I arrived, you could go into the perimeter of the Washington Hilton, no security. I then entered the actual hotel, no security. I walked through reception. There were members of the public, people staying at the hotel, mingling, looking at people on the red carpet. Then I walked through reception, no security. Then downstairs to the terrace level, just before the ballroom, no security. You just had to show this little yellow ticket that you had. No name on it, no passport, nothing. I couldn't believe it. And then there was one metal detector. No x-ray or anything, just you sort of had to put your phone and things there. So the security would not be of a standard for any Australian airport or the New South Wales or Victorian parliaments. It was extraordinary to think of who was in the room and how vulnerable they were.
Can you give me a sense then of how vulnerable the US government was given that?
I think this is one of the most vulnerable moments that the US government has had in certainly in modern times. To think that the three lines of succession there, the president and the vice president together, a few metres apart on the main table, and then in the same room, not far from them, is the number three in the succession, Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and then all the cabinet ministers dotted all through. CBS, for example, had the Secretary of Defence, Pete Hegseth, and, you know, a lot of the media organisations have these people as their guests. So the vulnerability of the American government last night was extraordinary, and I don't think they can ever allow that to happen again.
Given there has been a previous attempts on Donald Trump's life, some of them coming very close to being successful, there was much made at those times of the need for the Secret Service to step up its job. Will there be more focus on security agencies again following this?
Well, I think there has to be. I mean, this, as you say, this is the third time there's been an apparent assassination attempt on this president. And the fact that the alleged shooter, he travelled by train, he didn't have to sort of go through the security of the guns and the knives that he brought with him. He checked in legitimately to the hotel Friday night, the night beforehand, when there was no security at all, not even metal detectors. So the idea that you can have members of the public knowing for months that at that date, on that night, at that time, the President of the United States would be in this ballroom in a hotel that's impossible to secure. Back entrances, basements, staff coming and going, kitchen staff, food deliveries. It was extraordinary that this was allowed to happen. And I'm sure from now on they're going to have to tighten security. And I'm sure Donald Trump will want that.
John Lyons in Washington there. The acting US Attorney General Todd Blanche has told ABC America the suspect should be charged in the coming hours.
This was tragic. It was a night that none of us will forget for a very long time. But do not forget that the system worked. The Secret Service kept us safe, and that man was quickly apprehended and subdued minutes, seconds after he tried to breach the perimeter.
The acting US Attorney General Todd Blanche there. And following the incident, Buckingham Palace says discussions have been taking place with American officials to refine security arrangements ahead of the King and Queen's state visit to the US. The royals head to Washington later today for a four-day trip. And it comes at a tense time for the US-UK relationship, as Europe Bureau Chief Mazoe Ford reports from London.
With a glittering state banquet, a carriage procession and a military guard of honour, US President Donald Trump revelled in the royal pageantry on his state visit to the UK last year.
The bond of kinship and identity between America and the United Kingdom is priceless and eternal.
7 months on, the sparkle's worn off, and the so-called special relationship between the allies has fractured over the war in Iran. This was British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer in March.
This is not our war, and we are not going to be dragged into it.
And, you know, unfortunately, Keir is not Winston Churchill.
To try to repair the rift, Downing Street's deploying King Charles and Queen Camilla to Washington this week. Royal commentator Afua Hagen.
The optics of King Charles III travelling to the United States, shaking hands with Donald Trump, whilst Donald Trump is waging a war against Iran, is horrible at best. But on the converse, we do need someone to smooth over the relationship. King Charles III is our diplomat in chief. He's very good at sort of walking that tightrope.
This will be Charles's 20th trip to the United States, but his first as king. Buckingham Palace says the goal is to reaffirm and renew ties. But that soft power play is being met with some hard criticism from ordinary Brits.
It's really shocking for me that the King of Britain is visiting someone it's so extreme.
When I first heard about it, I thought it was quite a sensible diplomatic thing to do. But because of the situation that we're now in with this war in Iran and everything else that's going on in the world, I think it'd be silly to go.
If the King goes to meet Donald Trump, they would preemptively be reinforcing Donald Trump's behaviour.
Analysts say the relationship runs deeper than the two leaders.
The cooperation is still taking place. The dialogue is still happening. The intelligence is still being shared. And this is what matters at the end of the day.
Luke Coffey is a senior fellow with foreign policy think tank, the Hudson Institute.
I speak to officials on both sides of the Atlantic, and there appears to be no cracks at all. But what the public sees is this very visible divide between Keir Starmer and Donald Trump, and I think both are just pandering to their own domestic audiences.
The state visit's also controversial because King Charles won't be meeting with survivors of the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who was friends with his brother Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. This is Mazoe Ford in London reporting for AM.
Healthcare and water management are the biggest concerns for voters in the electorate of Farrer as they head to a by-election in less than 2 weeks. The federal seat, which covers a large expanse of southern New South Wales, was held by former coalition leader Susan Lee and had been one of the safest Liberal or National seats for decades. but they're expected to be usurped by either an independent candidate or One Nation, which some experts say signifies more broadly the decline of the major parties. Catherine Gregory reports.
Locals in Albury in southern New South Wales have long been vying for an upgraded hospital in the town that can support the region's growing population. Janet Howie is the editor of the Border Mail, a newspaper which covers the area. She's been gauging sentiment ahead of the Farrer by-election.
Many of the candidates, in fact possibly all by now, do feel that a new hospital is needed, but there are different ways they feel of bringing this about.
Janet Howie says beyond Albury, most people are also against the water buyback scheme, which involves the government buying back water from farmers for environmental purposes.
Many of the candidates want to see an end to water buybacks and just an improved water management in general.
Farrer has long been coalition heartland, but after Susan Lee's resignation in February, it's now up for grabs.
The amazing thing is that we're not talking about a Liberal win, given it's been in Liberal hands for the last 25 years. And the fact that we're talking about Michelle Millthorpe and the Independent and the One Nation candidate, David Farley, as being the leading contenders.
Doug Curran is the Mayor of Griffith, and what he's been hearing from voters is that more workers are needed for the region.
We're looking for anywhere up to 500 employees in Griffith on any given day.
Doug Curran explains the town has been built on migrant workers, which is at odds with One Nation's immigration policies. But he insists One Nation candidate David Farley has read the room.
The One Nation candidate in Farrer hasn't been too disparaging about immigration. Obviously, the party policy may not be aligned with what we see in Griffith as very successful immigration.
On Sunday, Pauline Hanson spoke at an anti-immigration rally in Canberra, echoing David Farley's more careful approach on the subject, followed by a very confident call on Farrer.
My tune has not changed. I am not against migration at all. You have to do it in a managed way. You have to bring in the right people who want to assimilate.
Liberals leader Angus Taylor has defended the decision to preference One Nation ahead of the independent candidate at the by-election.
The truth is that we don't want to see teal policies for Farrer or for this country.
Tony Barry from consultancy group Redbridge explains the Liberal strategy.
For the Liberal Party at the moment, it's like driving a car with no brakes. So there's no perfect solutions, there's only imperfect choices. And at the moment, I think their strategy is to get to second in the national polls. So at the moment, they're coming third. At the last federal election, it was 33%. And on the latest Redbridge and News polls, the non-major party vote was knocking on the door of 50%.
Tony Barry from Redbridge there, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. Youth homelessness is worsening, and support groups are finding it's much harder to get young people into community housing than older Australians. It's because community housing providers can earn as much as 50% less for housing an 18 to 22-year-old on youth allowance than they do for housing a person on the age pension. Oliver Gordon reports.
Community worker Narelle Clay says more vulnerable young people than ever are becoming stuck in the country's housing system.
I've been around almost 40 years. It's always been a problem. But the increase in numbers is horrendous.
The head of Southern Youth and Family Services in New South Wales says young people experiencing homelessness face a structural barrier.
They become homeless and they then cannot get out of it because there is nowhere for them to go where they can afford to go. No rental property, no community housing property.
There are many reasons vulnerable young people who find themselves close to homelessness struggle to secure tenancies. One of them, according to the CEO of Homelessness Australia, Kate Colvin, is money.
So we want to see government bridge the gap between rent that a young person pays in social housing and the rent that someone older pays.
Advocates call this gap, which sees community housing providers paid less for housing younger people on welfare payments, the youth housing penalty.
Currently, a young person would be paying 54% less rent, say, than someone on the disability support pension, on the age pension. And what that means then is that those prospective tenants get the property and the young person misses out.
Kate Colvin wants the federal government to compensate housing providers for this structural gap as part of the next budget.
That's probably looks like a youth housing supplement, so an additional payment to community housing providers for each young person housed of around $5,000 per young person.
Intergenerational equity has become a priority for the Albanese government, and Treasurer Jim Chalmers has indicated the principle will be a major theme of his May 12 budget. Kate Colvin says introducing this new payment will level the playing field for the young Australians trying to get into social housing and save the federal government money it would have spent on social supports and healthcare in the future.
We've had government investing in social housing, but it's not getting to young people because of this youth housing penalty.
For community services worker Narelle Clay, the measure is a small step forward that's urgently needed.
It won't fix homelessness entirely, but it will absolutely make a difference to young homeless people.
In a statement, a spokesman for the Federal Housing Minister said the Albanese government would keep working closely with community housing providers to ensure more young people can access safe, stable and affordable homes.
Oliver Gordon. Australia has 500,000 kilometres of bitumen connecting cities, the regions and rural parts of the country. But right now, the supply of high-quality bitumen is constrained by the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. It's sending prices soaring. Alternative bitumen has been sourced from the Gulf of Mexico, but it doesn't meet Australia's current road standards. Janae Madden reports.
A conveyor belt pumps out a sticky black material, connecting the most remote outback to the city and everywhere in between.
It's what connects our communities, connects commerce to markets.
Tony Alozio is the CEO of the Australian Flexible Pavement Association, representing the entire road industry, from overseas suppliers to the workers painting white lines. It's a $27 billion industry, and it employs thousands across the country. Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz has caused a chokehold of the key ingredient of roads, bitumen.
We've got a bitumen crisis along with the fuel crisis, and also like diesel, there's no great reserve of bitumen sitting in Australia that can just fill the breach.
Australia has just 30 days worth of supply before bitumen tankers start to run dry, according to the nation's leading transport research body. Normally, bitumen, a byproduct of crude, is imported from refineries in Singapore, Thailand, and South Korea. Suppliers have turned to the US and Venezuela, but that bitumen doesn't meet Australia's current standards. Michael Caltabiano is the CEO of the National Transport Research Organisation.
So we've developed standards in Australia for our climatic conditions to ensure that we maintain ductility. You know, we're a very sun-intensive nation, so bitumen oxidises very quickly under our natural conditions.
Since the 70s, Australian roads have been paved with what's known as a Class 170 bitumen, a standard that has persisted despite an extensive review of road quality controls in the last decade. But the imported alternative, Class 240, is harder and less suited to Australia's climate.
And they won't last as long, they'll oxidise quicker.
And that could shorten the life of Australian roads, experts say, by about 30%.
We will have a problem in 6, 7, 8 years' time where we'll need to refresh and rejuvenate earlier than we would have using our traditional supply lines.
Local councils manage 75% of Australia's road network, and many are already under pressure. Australian Local Government Association President Matt Burnett says any increase in maintenance will hit regional areas hardest.
The further west you go and the further regional, remote and rural councils you go, the more impact is going to be because of the sheer tyranny of distance.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Transport Minister Catherine King said the Australian government is working closely with states and territories and industry representatives on the impact the Middle East conflict is having on supply chains, including for bitumen and other materials used in road construction and maintenance. Australia is expected to begin using Class 240 bitumen within weeks.
Janae Madden. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was a video that went viral and left viewers outraged. In it, it's revealed the government receives more money from a tax on beer than from the tax on the profits of massive oil and gas projects. Today, the ABC's chief digital political correspondent, Claire Armstrong, on the growing campaign for a new gas tax. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.